Talk given Saturday, 23rd February 1980. It is essential for us to have a proper sense of the trend of life in us. What is life moving us towards? Life is universal, and it expresses a trend in all the different species that exist on the globe, including man. And the trend for man is something extraordinarily different from the trend for the innumerable animal species that exist. And if we have some clear feeling and vision, if we have a clear vision of what this trend is, then one could live the human life in the full sense, which also means the religious life in the full sense, in the true deep sense. Now, we may regard this trend as an energy which promotes the growth in each one of us of all the possibilities in relation to our modes of consciousness, our modes of awareness of existence. Now here, there are various forces at work. There is, first and foremost, natural evolution. And evolution, the evolutionary drive through the millennia, makes the organism, the psychophysical organism, more and more refined, it increases the complexity of the organism. And this complexity is essential because depending upon the complexity depends the functioning of the organism. Structure and function always go together. If the complexity gets out of hand, then there is complication, and that is the state of dis-ease. But if that complexity works perfectly, it's like a perfect machine, then everything goes well. You can rely upon it, and it promotes growth in the true sense. Also, with increasing complexity, there is an increasing sensibility and an intensification of our sensitivity, as well as our power to respond in the right way to all that we become sensitive to. Now, this is what nature does for us. It is concerned essentially with bringing the organism, the physical organism, to maturity, which it does with considerable success. It is we who, through our ignorance and through our slavery to the pleasure drive, and various other factors like that who spoil the process. And therefore, we suffer the consequences of it in so many ways, not only individually, but as a society, nationally and internationally. Now, the right care of the organism is our personal responsibility, and the right care involves, as you all already know, looking after the body so that it remains healthy. It involves our habits with regard to food and drink, and the amount of work we do, exercise, sleep, and all those factors come in. That is our responsibility. And we have to deal with all those aspects in relation to the fact that if we do this in the right way, then mind has the chance to come to maturity. And the maturing of the mind depends, of course, fundamentally upon the purification of the psyche and the sharpening of our perceptiveness. The growth of our sensitivity to all that the world pours into us through our senses. Consider for a moment, supposing a person is born blind. He has only four senses at work instead of five. Now his whole understanding of the nature of the world, of his own nature, and his capacity to respond to that will be very, very limited. If suddenly sight were restored to him, he would be completely astonished to see the world as we see it now. But it mustn't be thought that because we have five senses, therefore we have every avenue, a sense avenue, through which to apprehend the whole of existence and ourselves and be able to judge and alter where necessary our behavior and our ordinary everyday way of life. If we had six senses or seven senses, how completely different everything would be. And with that sort of experience, our own consciousness would be of a different nature. So we must appreciate the fact that nature does so much for us, and we have to do the rest. Now, we have emphasized time and again the importance of mindfulness, being clearly aware of everything that comes to us and the way we respond to it, and so forth. And nature plus our mindfulness moves us towards the state of communion, the state of communion, which means the real fulfillment of the human species. A communion in which the totality, we are restored back into the totality in full awareness of its nature and with the capacity to cooperate fully and completely with the process of the totality, with the universal process. You may recall we have considered the meaning of this word subsuming. And I illustrated it in terms of a solid object. Now, the human kingdom has developed so far that it is conscious of three dimensions in space. And whatsoever spatially is three-dimensional can be grasped by us and understood by us. So we know the meaning of the no-dimensional state, the one, two, and three-dimensional state. And because our human consciousness spatially is capable of three dimensions, of grasping three dimensions, therefore whatsoever is a surface or a line or a point is within our understanding, within the sphere of our understanding. And where time is concerned, we have only a one-dimensional time consciousness. It moves in a straight line, so to say. Past, the present moment, and the future. But that doesn't mean, therefore, that this exhausts all our possibilities. Because we use words like infinite or infinitude, we use words like timelessness and eternity, and we use words like immortality. Now, these words represent that which transcends the dimensions of space and time and our ordinary consciousness, which functions as it does at present. When, for example, and there are possibilities which lie within our ken, so to say. You know how in the Buddhist presentation with regard to the realization of complete communion, the samadhi, in the Buddhist presentation we have the four jhanas, as they are called, and then the four samapattis. The first one of the samapattis, which is the infinity of akasha, and the second the infinity of vijnana. Now this means that he who can in the process of meditation enter this infinity of Akasha is no longer restricted to a three-dimensional space consciousness. It becomes multidimensional. It becomes infinite, so that he completely transcends all finitude spatially and functions in terms of infinity spatially. But what that sort of functioning is extremely difficult to talk about. It's something which is transcendent to us. But the important point to remember is that transcendence completely subsumes all that which is not transcendent. And it is for man, it is given to man to arrive at that condition where he can become aware, he can wake up to the transcendent. With time, man does experience and can realize timelessness. We all know that. This timeless state, when the attentiveness is so intense that the passing of time does not bind consciousness anymore. His consciousness is free of bondage, servitude to time as such. So that from temporality, subjection to time, he can awake to timelessness. But that is not the end point, so to say, where the time consciousness is concerned. Because the experiencing of timelessness for us, however developed, the perfected holy ones included, the awakening to the timeless condition has a beginning in time, and it comes to an end in time because of the necessity for the organism to feed, to drink, and so on, the things it has to do in order to exist at all. Therefore, there is a beginning and an ending of timelessness. And therefore, it is not identical with eternity as such. But eternity is the sort of supreme limit, the supreme state of transcendence. But it's something which is on the way. So you have these two samapatis. And remember that the word samapati does not mean attainment as given in the dictionary in this context. It is something other than attainment. It is better translated, and this comes really from the Sanskrit texts, not the Buddhist Sanskrit, but the Hindu Sanskrit texts, that samapati means a coalescence, like a river comes, finally ends up in the sea, in the ocean, and the river as a river is completely absorbed by the sea. It is, as we say, lost in the sea. And eternity is of this nature. You see, it's not like the state of timelessness, which begins and ends. A river has a source and it has an end. But when it ends, it has become completely absorbed into the absolute, so to say. The ocean relatively is absolute in relation to the river. So there is this this state of eternity, which is very, it's important to understand something of the nature of eternity, not imagine at any moment that we touch eternity. We don't. We can experience timelessness, but not the eternal. And, of course, time is associated with mortality, a beginning and an ending, a birth and a death. And in the sphere of mortality, it is life which releases the phenomenon of birth, and it is life which releases the phenomenon which we commonly call death. Our idea of death is an idea which is associated with fear and with sorrow. Quite naturally, we can't help that. But the transcending of the fear and the sorrow aspect comes only through being finally entering the profound meditative states as such. And remember that they all have their root in dealing with the psychophysical organism in the right way. This is a very important point. The right treatment of the psychophysical organism. The great religions of the world have presented the person as a temple. Know ye not, for example, in St. Paul writes, for example, know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High. And in the Upanishads, the Skanda Upanishad and the Maitreya Upanishad, you find the statement outright. The body is the temple. The dweller in that temple is Shiva, the third person of the Trinity. Shiva, who is presented as the regenerator, the creator, the absorber of creation, and then the regenerator. People forget that, and they say that Shiva is presented as a destroyer. But the word destroy is a word which gives us a wrong impression. Destruction we feel more or less in terms of annihilation. But there is no such thing as annihilation at all. The totality is perpetually alive, everlastingly alive. We use the phrase eternal life quite correctly. That is not a misuse of words. Life is eternal. It is not merely timeless. It shows the phenomena of birth and death. So long as consciousness is confined to unidirectional time, and of time, and it shows the phenomenon of timelessness in as and when one can enter into the deep meditative states. But life itself is eternal. Brahman is prana, and since Brahman is the absolute all, and if that is life, life too is the absolute all. There's another aspect to it. Brahman is the absolute all consciousness. And so consciousness, in that sense, awareness, if you like, in the profound sense, is something which is altogether eternal. It is not just subject to time, to temporality, not caught within time. And our consciousness undergoes various stages of development. in the various animal species, it is limited, as we all know. And with the animal's death, that's the end of consciousness where that animal is concerned. But consciousness or awareness, where we are concerned, can realize timelessness, and we can relate it, at least through our through vision, through our through unerring insight, the power of unerring insight to the eternal. The importance of that is just this, that it keeps us on an even keel and enables us to live purely and humanly. And insofar as we live purely and humanly, individually, we affect the totality. We affect all mankind. You may be interested to hear this. Professor Kaiser, reading through The Heart of Religion, wrote to me saying that what you say along these lines is of very great importance, because insofar as there are people, even though there may be very few people, who think and speak along these lines, are helping the whole world to see, to be able to see what is true and distinguish it from what is false. Now, Professor Kaiser is the successor of I've again forgotten his name. Friedrich Heiler, who was professor in Marburg before him. I met Heiler. We were on the same platform at Cambridge at a conference of the World Congress of Faiths. And I noticed how very much at home he was with the deeps, the real profundities of all the religions of the world. And he, in his turn, came up to me and talked about that and said, it's so good to hear a talk like yours, because this is the thing which is of real help to everybody. So I'm mentioning this not to sort of suggest what a wonderful person I am, but that the kind of thing we consider and the kind of thing we are trying to see and live by is of fundamental importance, not only to individuals, ourselves and our friends and those with whom we come in contact, but to all mankind. Now, as and when one enters into the deep states and realizes that the final state possible for man, the samadhi, the perfect samadhi, the perfect communion, the state of the ultimate contemplative prayer, the Unio Mystica, as it is called, then it is the totality which comes to fulfillment and fruition as man through the individual, through the individual man or woman. And that is the real fulfillment of the purpose of our human existence. If we use the common word common to so many of the great religions, and a word which all human beings know, God comes to fulfillment as man and displays perfect manhood through the man or the woman who has so purified himself or herself and lives the religious life in the full sense. So one can understand the deep meaning of the statement, unto God the glory, not unto ourselves. We can understand why in the Gita Sri Krishna says, perform all actions as unto me and not as unto, not for your own sake. Do not live the holy life in order that you may gain something and you may escape sorrow and all the rest of it. But do it for the fulfillment of the totality, because Krishna is regarded as God incarnate. Therefore, whatever is done unto Krishna is done unto the totality, unto transcendence itself. I'm sure that there is so much that can still be done, reinterpreting the old scriptures. It's not at all an easy task, and of course it needs a person in real good health in order to carry on that work. Take a very long time to effect such a thing. But with meetings like ours, in small ways, little crumbs, shall we say, fall from the table. And they may be useful spiritual food. Now, the growth of consciousness, which means the awakening to the deeper and deeper reality, the truth of things as such, means that we fade out of our ordinary mode of awareness into a profounder mode. This fading out means that one mode of being dies. That is to say, one mode of awareness of existence dies. It is transmuted into non-being. Now, this is a very important point. Sri Krishna's words again, being and non-being am I, he says. So it's something which occupied me a couple of years. How can you be being and non-being simultaneously? Now, the significance of this is tremendous, really. Non-being is the one unitary absolute whole. There can be no other non-being. And being, and out of non-being, there are expressed multitudinous, countless beings. You see? Because the being is finite, he is temporal, he is mortal. Whereas non-being is infinite, eternal, immortal. You see? But insofar as any one being, you or you or you or I or whoever it is, begins to see this, begins to, first of course, there is bound to be the intellectual grasp of it. We are restricted to that. And then, if that intellectual grasp, coupled with the purification of the psyche, enables us to enter into the state of actual communion, where these are not mere words or thoughts or ideas, but actualities functioning livingly through us, then one understands what it is to be in the supreme communion. Being and non-being, that is to say, the infinite, the eternal and the immortal is something to which we are actually awake. We are not merely talking and merely spinning out cobwebs of philosophy. This is the important point. You can't avoid philosophy, because whatsoever even the perfected holy one said, you know how the Buddha did not touch metaphysics, as the big scholars say. But I wouldn't accept that, for the simple reason that in all the great religious teachings, you will find that there is an implied metaphysics. You can't get away from it. There is an implied metaphysics. There is the conception of transcendence itself. The very use of transcendence, the very use of the word God or Brahman or anything, the very fact that there are statements made with regard to Brahman or Atma or God or transcendence means that there is this metaphysics beyond physics. Physics is a word derived from physis, which means nature, which means manifestation, which means therefore particularity and multitudinousness. You see? And metaphysics is that which attempts to go beyond the multitude and see the multitude as part of the ultimate one, the whole. And when that happens in our own consciousness, then that is actual, the manifestation of actual holiness, wholeness. You see, it is towards this that all yoga or religious discipline, etc., is directed. So now, one mode of being, which involves one mode of awareness, dies, and it is transmuted towards non-being. You get the feel of it? It's not too easy to talk about. Finitude is changed into the infinite, and temporality is changed in the ultimate into eternity. And this is the meaning of the word bliss in this context. It's not pleasure, it's not happiness as we ordinarily know it, or joy or ecstasy or anything like that. Bliss means that which is the finally transcendent counterpart of what we know as true happiness, true joy. The happiness which we never seek, but which just naturally comes to us. And you know, you get up in the morning, you see a lovely sunrise or beautiful dawn, or the beauty of the starlit nights, or the song of the bird, or the loveliness of a calm lake or sea or whatever it is. All that is the real happiness which is given unto us by nature, by Mrs. God, is given unto us freely, without our striving for it, without our having to pay any price for it. And the bliss and the peace of God, which passeth understanding, as the phrase goes, is of that nature, in transcendent in transcendent terms. So that when you read in the texts that Brahman is being, consciousness, bliss, sat, chit, ananda, it is in this sense that you must understand bliss, in the sense of the infinity of the one total existence, the eternity of it, and the immortality of it. You see how through the ages we have used words in our philosophies and in our religious teachings without having the slightest vision of what they really imply. And all that implication is for us as human beings. And this perhaps is one of the deep meanings of God's love for man. And also one of the meanings of the grace of God, that it is not withheld from us. It is available to us freely, just as the light and warmth of the sun is freely available to us, except when clouds intervene. And in our human lives, in our hearts and in our minds, it is we who manufacture all the smoke and the clouds and the horrible things which obscure the perfection and beauty of the transcendent, which is our birthright. That's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Now, when this change takes place from one mode of awareness to a profounder mode, and we are closer in touch, more awake to the deep reality of things, we are afraid of this change. We hold on, we cannot let go that which we already know, which is the limited, the particular, the mortal, the finite, you see. We are afraid to let it go. This fear is one of the great obstructions in our way to living the religious life in the full sense. We have to let go freely. And this fear is also our root fear, the fear of death, the death of the known. But the unknown, the real transcendent, can never be approachable until and unless we let go of the known. Because what we know is the limited, the finite. And the transcendent is the infinite, the unlimited. Now, one may wonder, this fear of letting go of the known, is this one of the meanings of the agony in Gethsemane? Could it possibly be that? It's something worthwhile meditating on. And when I say meditating on, don't muse about it, just sort of spin out thoughts. Just let the mind be quiet and see. Because you know, the different religions present this fear in different forms. You will find it in the Upanishads in their own particular form. I don't know whether it comes in Zarathustrian teachings, because the only wholly authentic teaching of Zarathustra which has come down to us is the Gathas of Zarathustra. And in those gathas there is nothing to suggest this sort of fear, you see, and this sort of agony. The agony of Gethsemane. And is this, one may ask also, is this crossing of the abyss, the dark night of the soul, what the mystics have called the dark night of the soul? It's a very curious thing. We may experience it in various ways, but be very careful how you label the experience. It is so easy to arrogate to ourselves deep mystical experiences because it satisfies our vanity and ego. Beware of vanity and ego. Egoism, that is. They are terrible devils to deal with. But if you can deal with them successfully, you will have the strength of God with you, which is represented by the Archangel Gabriel. Gabriel represents the power of God, and you will have, as in the Zarathustrian texts, the kshatra, which means the creative power of Ahura Mazda. Because if you can deal with these two demons successfully, vanity and egoism, in the course of the living of the spiritual life, then you get into touch, into rhythm, into step with the creative activity of the primordial creative energy, that pulse of creation. And that pulse of creation is terrific. If one is impure, it shatters us. That is why a good many people taking to yoga or taking to the religious life too seriously, that is to say, with the wrong kind of seriousness, go for it in such a way that they become a bit dotty, sometimes more than a bit dotty. So you be very careful about such things. If one understands these things, then one begins to see more clearly life's trend in us. And as one sees life's trend in us more and more clearly, one is able to be helped by this creative activity of the primordial creative energy, acting in eternity, mind you. That acts in eternity, not in time. You know how Sri Krishna says to Arjuna that he acts constantly, that if he did not act, these worlds would fall into ruin. That means, out of the creative activity in eternity of this creative energy, all that becomes manifest and which remains unmanifest also, all that is sustained by such activity. Otherwise all these worlds would fall into ruin. So you can imagine what it is like for a human being to so live that he begins to vibrate in harmony with that tremendous divine creative energy. What it means how the organism has to stand a multi-million volt current, spiritually speaking. That is why I have constantly said through all these years, why do you take to religion? Consider that carefully and beware. Keep away from religion in the true and the deep sense, unless one sees all that is implied in living the religious life in the full sense. But whosoever can tackle it and do it in the right way, there are some wonderful words in the book of Revelation. But he that overcometh, it starts with that. I have quoted it in the Heart of Religion, in the third chapter, I think. Yes, you'll find it there, from the book of Revelation. It is quoted. I'm sorry, I can't remember all that I would like to say, but I want to say, because I'm still suffering from the effects of what happened in November. It's very curious, but there it is.